This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, November 2022 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What did the woman like most about the hotel? B. How many stars will the man give the hotel in a review?
That was a great hotel.
Yes, it had everything. Some great shops and even a really well-equipped gym. What I'd definitely go back there for, though, is the restaurant. We ate in there every night. The pools were much bigger in reality than they looked in the pictures on the website, too.
It's usually the other way round. I'm going to write an online review of the hotel, actually. The only thing stopping me giving it 5 stars is how clean it was. If there were a separate mark for that, I'd definitely only give it 3. But balanced with all the other factors, I think 4's fair. That was a great hotel.
Yes, it had everything. Some great shops and even a really well-equipped gym. What I'd definitely go back there for, though, is the restaurant. We ate in there every night. The pools were much bigger in reality than they looked in the pictures on the website, too.
It's usually the other way round. I'm going to write an online review of the hotel, actually. The only thing stopping me giving it 5 stars is how clean it was. If there were a separate mark for that, I'd definitely only give it 3. But balanced with all the other factors, I think 4's fair.
Question 2. A. Where does the girl suggest meeting her friend? B. What does the girl want to do after seeing the film?
Oh, hi, it's me. Listen, you know we arranged to see a film together on Saturday morning. Well, I thought I'd be able to get a lift into town with my mum on her way to the office, which is why I suggested meeting at the cinema. But she's not working on Saturday now, so what do you reckon about seeing each other at the station at about 10 o'clock instead? We can get the train in together. I'm not sure I can face shopping after seeing a long film like that, but we could have lunch as the film finishes at about 1 o'clock. Anyway, ring me back. Oh, hi, it's me. Listen, you know we arranged to see a film together on Saturday morning. Well, I thought I'd be able to get a lift into town with my mum on her way to the office, which is why I suggested meeting at the cinema. But she's not working on Saturday now, so what do you reckon about seeing each other at the station at about 10 o'clock instead? We can get the train in together. I'm not sure I can face shopping after seeing a long film like that, but we could have lunch as the film finishes at about 1 o'clock. Anyway, ring me back.
Question 3. A. What animal was this week's nature program about? B. What annoys the boy about nature programs?
Did you see that documentary, Nature Watch, last night?
I did. I wouldn't want to miss a single episode from that series. I didn't think it was as good as last week's one on elephants, though.
I actually find dolphins much more interesting, so I thought last night's one was better. The next one's about bears, which should be great.
Yeah, I can't wait. I do have one issue with the series, though.
Oh, what's that?
I really can't fault the camera work, but I think whoever wrote the soundtrack shouldn't be asked to do it for a nature series again. It's really distracting.
Did you see that documentary, Nature Watch, last night?
I did. I wouldn't want to miss a single episode from that series. I didn't think it was as good as last week's one on elephants, though.
I actually find dolphins much more interesting, so I thought last night's one was better. The next one's about bears, which should be great.
Yeah, I can't wait. I do have one issue with the series, though.
Oh, what's that?
I really can't fault the camera work, but I think whoever wrote the soundtrack shouldn't be asked to do it for a nature series again. It's really distracting.
Question 4. A. When did the girl go to the photography exhibition? B. What is the topic of the photography exhibition?
You're into photography, aren't you?
I am. Why?
There's a great exhibition you should go to. It started a week ago. I wanted to go on the first day, but didn't have time to get there until last Monday. It runs until the 1st of December, so you've got plenty of time to see it.
What's so good about it, then?
Most photography exhibitions I've been to have quite adult themes, things like work or the countryside. This one's called Teenage Life, so seeing three rooms of pictures about just that was a really welcome change. I mean, I like looking at photos of landscapes, but not all the time.
Sounds good.
You're into photography, aren't you?
I am. Why?
There's a great exhibition you should go to. It started a week ago. I wanted to go on the first day, but didn't have time to get there until last Monday. It runs until the 1st of December, so you've got plenty of time to see it.
What's so good about it, then?
Most photography exhibitions I've been to have quite adult themes, things like work or the countryside. This one's called Teenage Life, so seeing three rooms of pictures about just that was a really welcome change. I mean, I like looking at photos of landscapes, but not all the time.
Sounds good.
That is the end of the four short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a talk by a scientist about birds called owls. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write one or two words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello everyone. My talk today is about some fascinating birds called owls. There are over 200 species of owls, the majority of which are active at night. They live in any habitat where food is plentiful, including urban areas. They're found on every continent except Antarctica, mostly in forests, but nowhere are the species as varied as in Asia. This includes the largest species, the great grey owl, which is also found in North America and Europe. Owls have been around on Earth for a long time. The evidence for this is found in fossils. These are skeletons of dead creatures which have gradually turned into stone over very long periods of time. The oldest fossil record of a bird dates back around 66 million years. This chicken-like creature lived 8 million years before the oldest owl found so far, a 58-million-year-old fossil of a species that died out long ago. Owls are famous for having extremely good eyesight, which they use for finding the small creatures they feed on. In order to spot these animals from a long way away, owls have tube-shaped eyes rather than having round ones like our own. Because of this, owls' vision is actually quite poor when looking at things close up. In common with the majority of birds, owls have three eyelids. Some species of birds use their third eyelid to protect their eyes whilst feeding, whereas for others, owls included, it's essential for keeping their eyes moist and clear of dust during periods of hunting. For birds that regularly dive underwater, the third eyelid keeps their eyes safe when they're swimming. Owls are also well known for how far they can turn their heads from side to side. One ancient story suggests that if you walk round a tree while an owl is watching you, the owl would be able to turn its head 360 degrees to either the left or right. In reality, however, their heads can move a still impressive 135 degrees in either direction. Part of what makes owls so successful at catching food is their ability to fly almost silently. Many of their feathers, especially those in their broad wings and the undersides of their bodies, are no larger than those of similarly sized birds, but are far softer. This means that most of the sound the owl makes as it flies is absorbed. When a number of birds of a particular species are seen together, they're given a special name. You can therefore refer to a group of ducks as a team, whilst parliament is the word used for a group of owls. Company is another one I'm particularly fond of, which is the name for a group of parrots. Owls have a special place in the myths and stories of many different cultures. For example, in various European regions, owls have long been thought of as symbols of wisdom. And even today, some Japanese people carry a small figure of an owl around with them for luck. This belief is similar in some ways to the protection that owls were thought to give certain Native American tribes. So now let's have a look at some pictures of owls.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hello everyone. My talk today is about some fascinating birds called owls. There are over 200 species of owls, the majority of which are active at night. They live in any habitat where food is plentiful, including urban areas. They're found on every continent except Antarctica, mostly in forests, but nowhere are the species as varied as in Asia. This includes the largest species, the great grey owl, which is also found in North America and Europe. Owls have been around on Earth for a long time. The evidence for this is found in fossils. These are skeletons of dead creatures which have gradually turned into stone over very long periods of time. The oldest fossil record of a bird dates back around 66 million years. This chicken-like creature lived 8 million years before the oldest owl found so far, a 58-million-year-old fossil of a species that died out long ago. Owls are famous for having extremely good eyesight, which they use for finding the small creatures they feed on. In order to spot these animals from a long way away, owls have tube-shaped eyes rather than having round ones like our own. Because of this, owls' vision is actually quite poor when looking at things close up. In common with the majority of birds, owls have three eyelids. Some species of birds use their third eyelid to protect their eyes whilst feeding, whereas for others, owls included, it's essential for keeping their eyes moist and clear of dust during periods of hunting. For birds that regularly dive underwater, the third eyelid keeps their eyes safe when they're swimming. Owls are also well known for how far they can turn their heads from side to side. One ancient story suggests that if you walk round a tree while an owl is watching you, the owl would be able to turn its head 360 degrees to either the left or right. In reality, however, their heads can move a still impressive 135 degrees in either direction. Part of what makes owls so successful at catching food is their ability to fly almost silently. Many of their feathers, especially those in their broad wings and the undersides of their bodies, are no larger than those of similarly sized birds but are far softer. This means that most of the sound the owl makes as it flies is absorbed. When a number of birds of a particular species are seen together, they're given a special name. You can therefore refer to a group of ducks as a team, whilst parliament is the word used for a group of owls. Company is another one I'm particularly fond of, which is the name for a group of parrots. Owls have a special place in the myths and stories of many different cultures. For example, in various European regions, owls have long been thought of as symbols of wisdom. And even today, some Japanese people carry a small figure of an owl around with them for luck. This belief is similar in some ways to the protection that owls were thought to give certain Native American tribes. So now, let's have a look at some pictures of owls.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about their relationship with their brothers and sisters. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I have one brother and 2 sisters, all of whom are younger than me. Age difference is much more of an issue when you're young, so I wasn't that close to any of them when we were little. I'd already grown out of playing with dolls and that kind of thing by the time they were into them. I guess it stopped us arguing over toys. As teenagers, we all got into playing music together, so now it's almost as though we're the same age.
Speaker 2.
My older brother and sister are both working in business now. I'm following a similar route, studying business at university like they did. It's reassuring that they're likely to have experienced many of the challenges I regularly face, so I'm straight on the phone to them when things come up. You might think that because we're all into business, we're very competitive people. Funnily enough, that's never really been a feature of our relationships. We have quite different personalities in some respects, but that's never stopped us from being close.
Speaker 3.
I've had disagreements with my brother and sister for as long as I can remember.
Even though occasionally we wouldn't talk to each other for days as a result, we always sorted it out eventually. Now we're teenagers, our lives have gone off in different directions in terms of the friends we have and the activities we enjoy doing. We see far less of each other and know very little about each other's lives, when before we knew everything. In many ways, I preferred the way it was back then.
Speaker 4.
I have an older sister and two younger brothers. I've heard of families who are so close they can almost read each other's thoughts. No idea why, but we're the exact opposite. In fact, we're so unalike, it's hard to believe we're from the same family. It's never been a problem, but our interests and choice of friends are as far apart today as they ever were. It's resulted in me making really deep friendships outside the family, so I've always got someone to turn to when I need it.
Speaker 5.
I'm the oldest of three children. My two younger brothers treat everything as though it's a game they have to win, even who has the most food on their plates at mealtimes. And any argument has to be won at all costs, so there's little time to forgive and forget between them. I've never become involved in any of that kind of behaviour, but it's been fascinating to observe. I can now accurately predict what's going on in their heads in pretty much any situation.
Speaker 6.
Although I can talk to my parents about more or less anything, I just can't with my older brother and sister. I know they're only trying to help, but they seem to think they know exactly what I'm like and what I ought to do in any situation, when in reality they don't. It sometimes leads to the occasional quarrel, but it's never taken as long to apologise and just move on. We're still close, even though we have different ways of dealing with things.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I have one brother and two sisters, all of whom are younger than me. Age difference is much more of an issue when you're young, so I wasn't that close to any of them when we were little. I'd already grown out of playing with dolls and that kind of thing by the time they were into them. I guess it stopped us arguing over toys. As teenagers, we all got into playing music together, so now it's almost as though we're the same age.
Speaker 2.
My older brother and sister are both working in business now. I'm following a similar route, studying business at university like they did. It's reassuring that they're likely to have experienced many of the challenges I regularly face, so I'm straight on the phone to them when things come up. You might think that because we're all into business, we're very competitive people. Funnily enough, that's never really been a feature of our relationships. We have quite different personalities in some respects, but that's never stopped us from being close.
Speaker 3.
I've had disagreements with my brother and sister for as long as I can remember. Even though occasionally we wouldn't talk to each other for days as a result, we always sorted it out eventually. Now we're teenagers, our lives have gone off in different directions in terms of the friends we have and the activities we enjoy doing. We see far less of each other and know very little about each other's lives, when before we knew everything. In many ways, I preferred the way it was back then.
Speaker 4.
I have an older sister and two younger brothers. I've heard of families who are so close they can almost read each other's thoughts. No idea why, but we're the exact opposite. In fact, we're so unalike, it's hard to believe we're from the same family. It's never been a problem, but our interests and choice of friends are as far apart today as they ever were. It's resulted in me making really deep friendships outside the family, so I've always got someone to turn to when I need it.
Speaker 5.
I'm the oldest of three children. My two younger brothers treat everything as though it's a game they have to win, even who has the most food on their plates at mealtimes. And any argument has to be won at all costs, so there's little time to forgive and forget between them. I've never become involved in any of that kind of behaviour, but it's been fascinating to observe. I can now accurately predict what's going on in their heads in pretty much any situation.
Speaker 6.
Although I can talk to my parents about more or less anything, I just can't with my older brother and sister. I know they're only trying to help, but they seem to think they know exactly what I'm like and what I ought to do in any situation, when in reality they don't. It sometimes leads to the occasional quarrel, but it's never taken as long to apologise and just move on. We're still close, even though we have different ways of dealing with things.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with a man called Liam Batchelor, who spent 2 years cycling around the world. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
I'm delighted to welcome Liam Batchelor to the programme. Liam, you've just completed a 2-year round-the-world cycling trip. What made you want to do it?
I guess listeners might be disappointed to hear that my motivation wasn't actually to generate thousands of pounds in sponsorship for a good cause, but the more simple prospect of seeing as many countries as I possibly could in a single trip. The idea of a couple of years away from work was also extremely appealing, but it wasn't what got me onto the bike.
Tell me about the bike you used.
It turned out to be the most expensive one I looked at, but I had no particular budget in mind anyway, so it wasn't really an issue. I'm not an expert on bikes, but have friends who are. I'm sure they'd have been delighted to suggest what they thought would be best for me. Rather than relying on someone else's judgment, though, I tried a few different ones, then bought the bike I imagined would hurt least after several hours of sitting on it.
What else did you do before setting off?
I was planning to get temporary jobs when I needed to during the trip, but wanted to keep this to a minimum, so worked extra hours to make sure I had as much as possible in the bank before I set off. I'd decided against choosing exactly which roads to take beforehand, as doing that would have taken a lot of the fun out of the trip. I wasn't incredibly fit before I set off. I knew that'd develop once I got going, though, so didn't do much extra exercise.
So how were the first few weeks of the journey?
Hard work. But I felt alive in a way I hadn't for years. The only major headache came at one of the borders, where the guards insisted I should have got a transit visa instead of a tourist one. The map I was using was a bit out of date, but the fact I never got lost shows it was fine. And although I set off in winter, the storms I was expecting never actually appeared.
After leaving Europe, you travelled through parts of Africa. How was that?
Amazing. Everyone I'd met on the journey up to that point had been very welcoming, so I had no reason to believe Africa would be any different. The way people dressed and lived their lives, and the way buildings were decorated and so on, changed significantly from place to place, which I hadn't imagined. I was aware that the geography would vary greatly, though.
Did you develop a daily routine?
That was actually part of what I was trying to get away from, so I avoided it. Setting a minimum distance to cover each day seemed more like punishment than pleasure. One blog I'd read suggested learning a bit of each language I might have to speak, but I'd have had to learn about 50, so I didn't bother. I did make a point of sampling at least one regional dish each day, though, which was always an interesting experience.
How important was the internet during your journey?
Well, searching for Wi-Fi and constantly uploading photos and sending loads of emails to friends was the opposite of what I wanted from the trip. And it was never my aim to generate income by writing a blog, as many people do. I actually limited my time online to an hour every couple of weeks, just to let my family know I was okay.
So, what are your plans for the future?
Well, the trip hasn't magically turned me into someone who'd get a thrill from racing. But I definitely want to do more cycling. My intention is to ride from one side of Australia to the other, as my route around the world didn't take me there at all. I can do shorter rides around the UK, where I'm actually from, when I'm older and not as adventurous.
Many thanks, Liam.
Now you will hear the interview again.
I'm delighted to welcome Liam Batchelor to the programme. Liam, you've just completed a 2-year round-the-world cycling trip. What made you want to do it?
I guess listeners might be disappointed to hear that my motivation wasn't actually to generate thousands of pounds in sponsorship for a good cause, but the more simple prospect of seeing as many countries as I possibly could in a single trip. The idea of a couple of years away from work was also extremely appealing, but it wasn't what got me onto the bike.
Tell me about the bike you used.
It turned out to be the most expensive one I looked at, but I had no particular budget in mind anyway, so it wasn't really an issue. I'm not an expert on bikes, but have friends who are. I'm sure they'd have been delighted to suggest what they thought would be best for me. Rather than relying on someone else's judgment, though, I tried a few different ones, then bought the bike I imagined would hurt least after several hours of sitting on it.
What else did you do before setting off?
I was planning to get temporary jobs when I needed to during the trip, but wanted to keep this to a minimum, so worked extra hours to make sure I had as much as possible in the bank before I set off. I'd decided against choosing exactly which roads to take beforehand, as doing that would have taken a lot of the fun out of the trip. I wasn't incredibly fit before I set off. I knew that'd develop once I got going, though, so didn't do much extra exercise.
So how were the first few weeks of the journey?
Hard work. But I felt alive in a way I hadn't for years. The only major headache came at one of the borders, where the guards insisted I should have got a transit visa instead of a tourist one. The map I was using was a bit out of date, but the fact I never got lost shows it was fine. And although I set off in winter, the storms I was expecting never actually appeared.
After leaving Europe, you travelled through parts of Africa. How was that?
Amazing. Everyone I'd met on the journey up to that point had been very welcoming, so I had no reason to believe Africa would be any different. The way people dressed and lived their lives, and the way buildings were decorated and so on, changed significantly from place to place, which I hadn't imagined. I was aware that the geography would vary greatly, though.
Mm. Did you develop a daily routine?
That was actually part of what I was trying to get away from, so I avoided it. Setting a minimum distance to cover each day seemed more like punishment than pleasure. One blog I'd read suggested learning a bit of each language I might have to speak, but I'd have had to learn about 50, so I didn't bother. I did make a point of sampling at least one regional dish each day, though, which was always an interesting experience.
How important was the internet during your journey?
Well, searching for Wi-Fi and constantly uploading photos and sending loads of emails to friends was the opposite of what I wanted from the trip. And it was never my aim to generate income by writing a blog, as many people do. I actually limited my time online to an hour every couple of weeks, just to let my family know I was okay.
So, what are your plans for the future?
Well, the trip hasn't magically turned me into someone who'd get a thrill from racing, but I definitely want to do more cycling. My intention is to ride from one side of Australia to the other, as my route around the world didn't take me there at all. I can do shorter rides around the UK, where I'm actually from, when I'm older and not as adventurous.
Many thanks, Liam.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5. Part A. You will hear a scientist giving a talk about recent research into measuring the melting of ice in Antarctica and Greenland. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words, or a number, in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello, everyone. I've come to talk to you today about some recent research I've been involved with on the melting of ice around the world. As you probably know, global warming is leading to the melting of an alarming amount of the world's ice. My research project looked specifically at the ice in two regions, Greenland and Antarctica. In contrast with previous scientific studies that made use of photographs to measure the extent of the ice in these areas, lasers were employed instead, due to the increased accuracy they offer. What also made this project different was that we were measuring the volume of ice in ways that had never been done before. Most ice is found in what are called ice sheets, which rest on land, and these have been the subject of many recent investigations. The quantity held in what we call ice shelves that float on the sea, however, has proved almost impossible to measure until our study managed it. Perhaps one day we'll have the ability to measure the amount in icebergs too. Scientific research has shown that melting ice from anywhere, not just Greenland and Antarctica, poses a risk to low-lying areas of coastal land around the world. The water that's freed from ice as it melts inevitably ends up in our seas and oceans. The more that flows into them, the higher the sea level will become. In the last 20 years or so, sea levels have risen by around 14 millimetres. Ice loss from the two regions that we were researching is responsible for one-third of this, with the remaining two-thirds caused by melting ice from elsewhere in the world. These rises in sea level might seem quite small and may give a false impression of how much ice actually needs to melt in order to produce them. You'd probably agree that an Olympic swimming pool would hold quite a lot of ice. Well, the equivalent of 80 million of these melt each year in Greenland, with 47 million Olympic swimming pools worth of ice disappearing from the continent of Antarctica. Perhaps unusually, not all areas within these regions are losing ice. For example, while ice in the west of Antarctica is disappearing at a worrying rate, the thickness of the ice in the middle of the continent is increasing. This is because climate change is causing more snow to fall in that area, which turns into ice over time. Now you will hear the talk again. Hello everyone. I've come to talk to you today about some recent research I've been involved with on the melting of ice around the world. As you probably know, global warming is leading to the melting of an alarming amount of the world's ice. My research project looked specifically at the ice in two regions, Greenland and Antarctica. In contrast with previous scientific studies that made use of photographs to measure the extent of the ice in these areas, lasers were employed instead due to the increased accuracy they offer. What also made this project different was that we were measuring the volume of ice in ways that had never been done before. Most ice is found in what are called ice sheets, which rest on land, and these have been the subject of many recent investigations. The quantity held in what we call ice shelves that float on the sea, however, has proved almost impossible to measure until our study managed it. Perhaps one day we'll have the ability to measure the amount in icebergs too. Scientific research has shown that melting ice from anywhere, not just Greenland and Antarctica, poses a risk to low-lying areas of coastal land around the world. The water that's freed from ice as it melts inevitably ends up in our seas and oceans. The more that flows into them, the higher the sea level will become. In the last 20 years or so, sea levels have risen by around 14 millimetres. Ice loss from the two regions that we were researching is responsible for one-third of this, with the remaining two-thirds caused by melting ice from elsewhere in the world. These rises in sea level might seem quite small and may give a false impression of how much ice actually needs to melt in order to produce them. You'd probably agree that an Olympic swimming pool would hold quite a lot of ice. Well, the equivalent of 80 million of these melt each year in Greenland, with 47 million Olympic swimming pools worth of ice disappearing from the continent of Antarctica. Perhaps unusually, not all areas within these regions are losing ice. For example, while ice in the west of Antarctica is disappearing at a worrying rate, the thickness of the ice in the middle of the continent is increasing. This is because climate change is causing more snow to fall in that area, which turns into ice over time.
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two science students about an international storage bank for plant seeds on one of the Norwegian islands of Svalbard in the Arctic Sea, and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
That was a great talk.
Yes. And relevant to our project on the Svalbard International Seed Bank. It's such a great idea to have a storage bank for seeds taken from plants all around the world. The seeds can be kept cold enough there to be preserved for the future as a kind of insurance against climate change and things.
Yes. I discovered that Svalbard is the most northerly location in the world to receive scheduled flights, which was a factor when deciding to install the seed bank there. As well as taking tourists to the islands and delivering supplies to the residents, this meant seeds could be delivered easily too.
True. There's very little to see on the outside of the seed bank, apart from the entrance, as it's mostly underground. Svalbard's a Norwegian territory, and what's interesting about all Norwegian government-owned buildings is that, rather than having flags hanging outside them, as in many places, artwork is displayed on the exteriors, and the seed bank is no exception.
That's different. The seed bank has to be kept secure, of course, though the freezing temperatures must put people off trying to get in, and it's surrounded by thick concrete walls.
Yes, and there are several metal doors with combination locks too.
I read that armed guards weren't felt necessary as the number of polar bears living in the region are just as effective at keeping people away. Apparently, there's more of them on Svalbard than people.
Wow. Well, the seed bank doesn't need many staff. Seeds only arrive a few times a year. When boxes are delivered, seed bank employees are prohibited from opening them, so it's impossible to do physical checks of any kind to ensure there isn't anything in them that shouldn't be there. X-rays are taken instead.
Clever. I found out that melting ice has already caused problems there.
Really?
Yes. The bank's buried in land that's been permanently frozen for thousands of years. This is ideal because the seeds need to be kept at minus 18 degrees centigrade. Recently, though, some of the snow that Svalbard normally gets has been falling as rain. This melted the ground, which flooded part of the seed bank. The huge hall where the seeds are kept wasn't affected, but a tunnel leading to it was, so scientists are worried that the bank could flood more extensively in the future.
Let's hope not.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
That was a great talk.
Yes, and relevant to our project on the Svalbard International Seed Bank. It's such a great idea to have a storage bank for seeds taken from plants all around the world. The seeds can be kept cold enough there to be preserved for the future as a kind of insurance against climate change and things.
Yes. I discovered that Svalbard is the most northerly location in the world to receive scheduled flights, which was a factor when deciding to install the seed bank there. As well as taking tourists to the islands and delivering supplies to the residents, this meant seeds could be delivered easily too.
True. There's very little to see on the outside of the seed bank, apart from the entrance, as it's mostly underground. Svalbard's a Norwegian territory, and what's interesting about all Norwegian government-owned buildings is that, rather than having flags hanging outside them, as in many places, artwork is displayed on the exteriors, and the seed bank is no exception.
That's different. The seed bank has to be kept secure, of course, though the freezing temperatures must put people off trying to get in, and it's surrounded by thick concrete walls.
Yes, and there are several metal doors with combination locks too.
I read that armed guards weren't felt necessary as the number of polar bears living in the region are just as effective at keeping people away. Apparently, there's more of them on Svalbard than people.
Wow. Well, the seed bank doesn't need many staff. Seeds only arrive a few times a year. When boxes are delivered, seed bank employees are prohibited from opening them, so it's impossible to do physical checks of any kind to ensure there isn't anything in them that shouldn't be there. X-rays are taken instead.
Clever. I found out that melting ice has already caused problems there.
Really?
Yes. The bank's buried in land that's been permanently frozen for thousands of years. This is ideal because the seeds need to be kept at minus 18 degrees centigrade. Recently, though, some of the snow that Svalbard normally gets has been falling as rain. This melted the ground, which flooded part of the seed bank. The huge hall where the seeds are kept wasn't affected, but a tunnel leading to it was, so scientists are worried that the bank could flood more extensively in the future.
Let's hope not.
That is the end of Exercise 5 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.